Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop. By Polar, blood, sweat, and data. By CaliforniaTriathlon.org, five great 2019 race options, including Viking Dash Trail Run LA on April 7th. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, this last year we sent out 2,806 grants, totaling $4.3 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on iTunes or at Babbittville.com. And as always, endurance lives here. Our next guest, one of America's premier runners, her name is Becky Wade. Becky, how the heck you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm honored. And it's funny, as I'm reading some background on you. So you were into this running stuff pretty early in your life.
Yeah, I've been into it in different capacities for most of my life, really.
And did you grow up in Colorado?
No, I'm a Texas girl.
Ah.
So I've only been in Colorado for a little over 2 years, but before that, I was in either Dallas or Houston my whole life.
Okay, and so when did you find steeplechase? I love the steeple. I think that's the coolest sport there is. It's so fun to watch.
It is really cool, a little terrifying, but it was pretty natural for me as an event in college because I did the 300-meter hurdles in high school.
Yeah.
And so it became apparent later on in high school that I was really meant for the long distances, but having a hurdle background just made the transition to the steeple easier, and, you know, having a good aerobic base played into that as well. And so it was a pretty natural fit. And it never was, like, my primary event. I did run it at Olympic Trials, but it was always just kind of something I did for fun and not so much of a focus until, like, a couple months a year, kind of right before the big events, I would say.
So talk a little bit about some of the carnage you've seen in steeple.
Team or experience?
Yeah, it's so funny because I remember talking to this guy named Tom Hunt, who used to be American record holder, 10,000 meters, and he was a steeplechaser. He said, in most times when you're running, you fade a little bit. The thing with steeple is you don't fade. You, 1 second you're feeling great, next second there's a piano on your back and there's no in between.
Yeah, and that's if you don't eat it in the water pit.
Yes,
so
yes.
I've done that. I actually did that at my first Olympic trials back in 2012. Made the final and had this really aggressive race plan to just go out in front and just go for it. I like wasn't a favorite to be in the top 30, so I just figured might as well go for it. And ate it on one of the water pits early on and went from like third to last or something, tangled up with a few other women, which I still feel guilty about, but part of the event, you know, what we signed up for.
Well, exactly, and the worst part is, well, falling in the pit is one thing, but having people jump on you with spikes on is probably not good.
It's scary. It's really scary, yeah.
Wow. And so, but you made the trials in 2012, and also you went in 2016, you ended up getting back in the trials, but that was a little bit of a journey, right?
Yeah, it was really strange because I didn't find out until a couple weeks before the trials, I found out that the qualifying mark that I had achieved, they weren't going to count because that meet apparently didn't put cones up. Like, there was no evidence that I had stepped on a line or gone out of bounds or anything like that because I hadn't, but there was, like, footage from the race, and USATF saw that there weren't cones where there were supposed to be cones, and so they basically just nullified all of the times from that race. And because I'd already gotten the time, I hadn't raced steeple again.
Right.
So I could train and not travel. And so I ended up, like, flying to Portland last minute to chase the time, and the race was, like, a total downpour, didn't get the time again. Canceled all my plans because USATF told me, nope, you're not in. Sorry, out of luck. So me and my family all had, like, plane tickets and hotels and all that kind of stuff. So canceled that. And then the next morning, my name just reappeared on the list as accepted. And so that was how I found out. And then we just rebooked everything and went for it.
So they didn't even call you. I think I read something where you had you had protested a couple times, and it was like the third time. Then they changed it, but they didn't call you.
They didn't call me or my agent. Honestly, like the only way I found out was because a friend was looking at the injury list and was like, "Hey, did you know that you're actually on the steeple start list?" And I was like, "No, I'm definitely not." We've been like back and forth, and lo and behold, I looked online and I had just been changed from not accepted to accepted. Just like that single word on their website was the game changer.
And you had already canceled everything, so now you had to rebook everything.
My boyfriend, my parents, my coach, like all of us. Yeah.
Did they apologize, or was like, "Oh, well, that's the way it is. We're USA Track and Field. We can do whatever we want."
No, I never talked to anyone about, like, none of that.
So how did you end up doing in that? I can't imagine.
It was not ideal. I didn't race great. I can't even remember. I didn't make it to the final.
Right, that's all that matters.
It was a kind of roller coaster, and I hoped I would be able to, like, put all that behind me and rally. I wasn't totally successful in doing that, but it was a good lesson. You kind of always got to be ready if the opportunity arises, and it was a journey.
That's probably a great way to describe you as a runner. The journey. I mean, your first marathon, you run 2:30, and I think you're the longest you'd ever raced up until then was a 10K.
Yeah, technically, I did this half marathon when I was traveling the world. I did it in Finland as like a total last minute thing. I had not trained for it, but the person I was staying with was coaching an athlete and got me an injury. So I was like, yeah, sure. So I just like did a training run, but never actually raced anything above a 10K. Yeah, that's true.
And you win the race and you caught Sarah Kiptoo at mile 25. So you must be thinking, oh, this marathon thing, Cal International, it's no big deal. They go out and win one. What's the big deal?
Honestly, I had like such a really great, smooth first experience that like I was trying to not think that way, but it's hard not to when it goes so well. And like, I felt like it was an event that was just going to keep coming up to me, and that, my times are just going to drop and drop and drop. It hasn't really happened that way, but I have gotten better as an athlete and learned a ton and gotten a lot of experience. Still having a lot of fun with it, but yeah, it hasn't quite been like the progression that I assumed it would be after that first one.
What I really enjoyed reading about was your Watson Fellowship year, where you could go to five countries. Right? And you went to 22.
So there's not actually a limit on how many. And I'll just break down the fellowship to you really quick.
Sure. That'd be great.
Pretty curious. But so the Thomas J. Watson Fellowship is awarded every year to 40 graduating seniors all across the U.S. And each person who applies picks their own topic for the year. And so I was the only one of the 40 my year who had anything to do with sports, but I wanted to look at long distance running cultures and training styles all over the world. And other people in my cohort were looking at like astronomy, teaching, unicycling, things like that.
Right.
And so once the 40 of us were accepted, we basically were given a lump sum of money and said, okay, stick with the spirit of your project proposal, but you can do whatever you want with the money. You can go anywhere you want. We couldn't go back to the U.S. for a full year, and we were totally on our own, like not supposed to meet up with other fellows or former fellows or people that we know for more than, short stints of time. And so I got a little carried away in my first country when I was in the U.K. I was originally going to go to just five, and I just kept meeting people and getting more curious and invitations to stay with runners and coaches everywhere that I was like, okay, might as well take everyone up on their offers, and ended up going to 22 countries and, seeing so much more of the world than I thought I ever would.
Well, and you meet Peter Snell in Texas, who I've had on the show before, one of my favorite guys. That guy, what a legend he is. And he introduces you to people in New Zealand. And you end up going to New Zealand.
Yeah, and that's just kind of the way it worked. Like, in my first, like, I was in England. I was going to stay in London for, like, 8 or 10 weeks or something, and ended up having these Irish roommates, and they're like, oh, my gosh, you have to go to Finn Valley Athletics Club, their old club. They had this legendary coach, and so I was like, okay, cool. So I stayed with one of them, and then I just kept meeting people who were like, oh, you have to go to this awesome group in Switzerland. Here's my friend's contact address. I'm sure you can stay there. And it just happened like that the whole time I traveled. I was continually surprised and just, like, blown away by people's generosity and willingness to let me. I mean, no one knew me before. You know, I'm just this 5-foot female American runner who wants to learn about running in other, you know, different places. And people are like, sure, come stay with me. Like, follow me around, train with us. It was amazing.
Isn't it amazing how nice people are when you're traveling? And people are so scared of traveling, and they have no idea that everybody out there just they want to meet new people and expose people to their culture.
Totally, yeah, and like there are so many cool people and nice people that I met, and I've kept in touch with so many of them, and a few of them actually came to my wedding in Boulder. People that had hosted me in Japan, and had another friend from England come visit, and it's just cool because those connections just keep blooming and like growing, even though I've been back in the U.S. for like 5 years now.
What you're one of those people who just seizes every opportunity. So while you're in New Zealand, you do some of the Arthur Lydiard workouts and some of the trails they run. You do the Auckland Queen Street downhill mile.
Yeah.
And then you party at Haile Gebrselassie Selassie's house.
I know, it was a dream. Honestly, it was like one cool opportunity after the next. And sometimes it's hard to believe that, like, that was my life I lived for a year. But it's also easy now to look back and be like, oh, my gosh, it was so cool all the time. I was doing so much cool stuff. Because it was also really hard, you know, just bouncing. I think I averaged moving the place that I was staying at every 5 days for a full year. So I was, like, chronically jet-lagged. Little homesick. I'm really close to my family, and I've three siblings who are close in age to me, and, you know, being away from them for so long was hard, and I was still trying to train. You know, I was training a lot, but
yeah,
I was kind of forced to be flexible and more adaptable than I had been before. So there were challenges along the way, but for the most part, it was real cool.
Now, did you ever pay for a hotel room?
Yeah, I did a few times. I rented a flat in at my very first stop in Teddington, England. And I think I only ended up renting it for a month. I wasn't going to stay there like over 2 months, but got invitations and just kind of kept moving. But there were a couple times when I had like little getaways where I just needed to fill a gap, or I was stopping over in some country for a weekend or something like that. But not a lot of my budget was spent on hotel rooms. More of it was spent on plane flights and food.
And you went through, what, 11 pairs of shoes in 12 months?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You did a lot of running.
I did, yeah. I think I was averaging like 70 or 75 miles a week, which is not like crazy volume, but just the amount that I was moving and on trains, planes, boats, all that, like, It was a bit, pretty big load.
3,504 miles.
Yeah, you got it.
That is so cool. And I bet you've become really good at packing for travel.
Yeah, I actually just wrote a Runner's World article on it. But I'm pretty good. I was so minimal that year that everything that I, like, all of my belongings fit into a large backpack, a small, kind of like bowling style roller suitcase that was like smaller than a carry on almost, and then a tiny little kind of backpack that would fit like a couple books. So if it didn't fit in there, it just wasn't coming. And so I got to be really good at deciding like what was worth the room and the weight and what I could do without.
What did you learn about yourself through that year?
So I've always identified as, like, a really big planner and perfectionist, and type A, like pretty rigid, disciplined person. And that year taught me that not only am I capable of being flexible and more spontaneous, but my life is so much richer when I'm able to be like that. And I think that, that was really reflected when I raced my first marathon. I think it was like 4 or 5 months after I came back to the U.S. And all of these experiences were so fresh in my mind and my body. And I think that like that was my biggest takeaway and something that I constantly need to remind myself to be more like the traveling version of me.
Yeah, yeah. You think about it when you're doing a marathon. And you know it's exactly 26.2 miles. You know there's going to be 8 stations every mile or something. When you're running in Ethiopia and they say we're running, oh, about 30 minutes, and an hour and a half, 2 hours later, you're still out in the middle of nowhere, the races seem easy.
Exactly, yeah. It's like you just kind of got to go with it. And what else can you do when you're 5 or 6 miles from where you need to end up and you think you've just gone to the couple mile run, except, you know, just tuck in and hope the people that you're running with know where they're taking you.
So is the goal now the marathon for 2020 for the Olympics?
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's the event that I have most potential in, and I'm definitely going for it. But I'm not done with the track yet, and I think I have way more to give in the 5K especially, but also the 10K.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to race those potentially like later this summer, and then probably the trials as well as the marathon.
Nice. And now will you be running Boston Marathon?
Yes. Yep.
Nice. Have you run it before?
I've not. I've only heard everything about it. So I'm really excited. I've raced in Boston before, but not marathon weekend.
So what was this last year you ran London, and what was that experience like?
It was, I mean, the race itself was really amazing. London was one of my favorite cities in the world. That was where I started my whole Boston Fellowship trip and had a lot of good friends there. And just the way they put the race on is so professional and high class, and they bring in such good competition from around the world. So that was really cool. The race itself wasn't great for me. I think it was the hottest day in race history. And I got a cramp, which has happened in a couple of my marathons before, unfortunately. So it wasn't like a disaster, but it just wasn't like what I was hoping for. But for sure, that's a race that I'll go back to, and I think that'd be a great race to crush a PR in.
So you were obviously, when you were traveling with the Watson Fellowship, you're keeping track of everything, and then you put all that into a sort of a blog, and then that came out as a book. When did the book come out?
The book came out actually when I was at the 2016 trials.
Very fun.
So the blog helped a ton, but even more than that, I relied on the journals that I kept, just personal journals. Mm-hmm. I filled 3 notebooks, like cover to cover, writing every day, different things, and like including ticket stubs and pictures and all that kind of stuff. So I wasn't planning on writing a book and didn't really embrace that idea until like a year after I got back and was approached about it. But having that journal and, I don't know, like 5,000 pictures, something like that, and then my blog. And then as well as just still being in touch with a bunch of the people that were featured in my book, they helped to fill in a lot of gaps and names of places and stuff like that.
Were you surprised when you were doing your blog, Becky Runs Away, that people were responding to it did some people meet you along the way when they knew where you were going to be?
I did connect with some people through my blog. Some of the people that ended up hosting me had seen my blog, and I think it was on Let's Run homepage for a day or something.
Yep.
And I did have some people reach out and either like offer for me to stay with them or connect me to someone they knew where I was headed. It was really surprising because I really started it because I knew my mom would love it, and she like was going to be so worried about her little girl traveling by herself all over. So I was like, okay, instead of emailing you like every couple days, I'm just going to share this blog with, you know, friends and family and just keep them generally up to date with where I am and kind of what I'm doing.
So what
it ended up being cool. Yeah.
Very cool. What was your favorite experience from that year?
That's so hard to say. Favorite experience? I think that the runs that I did in Ethiopia on Mount Entebbe,
yeah,
which I wrote about in the book and have written about since, those were some of the coolest runs and just like experiences as a human in my whole life. Because they always started with, like, I would hike for almost an hour to get... I would first take, like, a little minibus kind of public transportation to the base of the mountain in the early morning. Sun still hadn't risen. And then I'd hike up an hour to kind of get where I would start running. And then I'd stash my backpack with this woman who ran, who owned this little market stall. And then I'd just kind of take off and... It's really rugged and pretty and high up there. It's like 10,000 something feet at the top. And I would just encounter runners, like some runners that I wouldn't usually recognize, and then tons of other just scattered groups that would invite me to run with them. And I mean, physically it was really challenging because it was so high and so steep and just undulating. But I think I just grew so much up there in terms of like, fortitude and just what I was talking about earlier, just like ability to kind of roll with the punches and run with other people whose schedules I had no idea of.
So as someone who has been running since fifth grade and travels the world and really a lot of people look at running as this, it's a little selfish. I'm just going out. I'm spending time by myself. But now you have this universal language of running that you're traveling the world with, and some people don't speak your language, but everybody speaks a language of running.
Yeah.
How did it make you feel about the sport and about, you know, just about running itself when you came back from that?
You know, I think it's really telling that I ended that year, which was totally focused on running and how people train and how people incorporate the sport into their lives. And I was so on fire about the sport, like even more when I ended than when I started. And so much of that has to do with the people that I met and just how open and generous and inclusive they were. And I just think there's such a cool global running community that it's easy to kind of forget about when we're training for something specific and we are really focused on ourselves and our own process. But there's so much more out there and just like so many great people who are doing similar things to what we're doing. I wish everyone could fully grasp that the way that my trip allowed me to.
Does it surprise you that basically you're a professional runner? I'm sure when you were in high school and even in college, your thoughts were, okay, I'll run for a while and then eventually I'll get a real job. And you know, you're a professional runner. You're traveling the world.
It does surprise me, and I laugh about it with my family because I'm one of four kids, two sets of twins, and growing up, I was, like, objectively the least athletic of all of us. I was always the one who was on the B team for basketball and who was, like, the one playing lacrosse who could, like, run and chase people down but, like, couldn't do a whole lot else. And my siblings were really athletic. They were, like, A-team stars and first to be picked on the playground and all that kind of stuff. So I clearly found my sport, but yeah, it is surprising that this is kind of how my life has shaped up to be.
So wait, two sets of twins, four kids, two sets of twins?
Yeah, we're just one grade apart. And so 31 and 30 are our ages of the two sets.
Wow. And everybody's close.
Really close. Yeah. We're both boy, girl. And yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, my best friends, and none of them are like runners in the sense that I am, but they've all run, well, besides my twin, he would not identify as a runner in any way, but like my sister has run a couple marathons in high school, and my brother's done several races, and like he's put in 100-mile a week before for fun, and
wow.
So they, including my parents, like are super supportive and just so into the path that I've chosen, even though it's like not traditional and, you know, challenging for all of us at times when I'm injured or things aren't going well, but they're just as invested in my running as I am.
So when I look at your, you know, your 111, 112 for half marathon, your PR for marathon obviously could be better, right? I'm sure when you're going to someplace like Boston, you're thinking, okay, I know I'm running fast for the half. I just ran a 112 in Houston. So I ran 111 there yesterday. This is the time. Is that sort of going through your head that I don't think I've come close to my best marathon yet?
Yeah, I agree. I think I have so much more in me, and so much of it just comes down to like what the day shapes up to be, and that's weather, that's my body, that's the competition, all of it. And the marathon's just such a beast because things really have to line up in order for it to be like that special moment. But I know it's coming, and I'm just going to keep plugging away until I get it.
I love it. Hey, Becky, thank you so much for taking time. It was really a pleasure to get to meet you over the phone, and hopefully we'll connect in Boston.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, I enjoyed this a lot.
Becky Wade has been our guest. Again, we're brought to you by Tough Man Triathlon Series, toughmantri.com, VeloFix, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, Polar, Blood, Sweat, and Data, californiatriathlon.org, five great 2019 race options, including Viking Dash Trail Run LA April 7th, by our Challenged Athletes Foundation. Our first 25 years, we've sent out over 23,000 grants and raised over $100 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville on iTunes, and as always, endurance lives here.